The placeholder, as Steve said for the talk, was how would a physicist design a bat? In fact, what I'm really going to do is talk about the physics of a baseball bat collision. I'll get into a little bit towards the end about implications of my studies of this for the design of bat, and in particular the wood versus aluminum issue. My website has some interesting stuff on the physics of baseball. Is this working? Okay, all right, fine. Yeah. Okay. Now, although I may say something about the optimum design of the bat, I will not say anything about the optimum design of the batter, because you can see it's already been done. There's a heavy Boston flavor to this panel, I'm pleased to say. Okay, so let me just start with a sort of a description in words about the ball-bat collision. It's a very violent collision. You have a 90-mile-per-hour fastball, bat speed of, say, 70 miles per hour, total of 160 miles per hour impact speed. The forces that the bat and the ball mutually exert on each other are very large, thousands of pounds, but they last only a fraction of a second, of order a millisecond or less, typically even less. During that time, the ball compresses, okay, it compresses by a significant fraction of its actual uncompressed size, comes to a momentary stop, then expands and propels back out again. And during this process, there's a conversion of energy, the kinetic energy of motion of the ball that becomes stored up in where you can think of the ball as being a spring. It's stored up into potential energy of the spring, and then it springs back. The potential energy converts back to kinetic energy, but not entirely. In fact, a lot of the energy is lost just due to friction, as we will see. The bat affects the ball, but Newton's law of action reaction says that the ball also exerts a force on the bat, and that has interesting consequences, which I will try to get into also. Now, in order to bring some focus to this subject, I want to ask the question, what leads to a well-hit ball? And a moment's reflection leads you to think that what you really want, whether you're swinging for the fences or just trying to punch the ball through the infield, you want the ball to be the exit speed of the ball as it leaves the bat to be as large as possible. Here are some interesting numbers here. So now I want to focus in on the question, what aspects of the collision lead to a large exit velocity? Okay. I'll pick these up later. Okay. So how does a bat work? So we want to maximize VF. The VF is my little symbol for the final speed of the ball. We want it to be large. So what does it depend on? Well, for sure it depends on the initial speed of the pitch ball, and it depends on the bat speed. Those are effects that I'm not particularly interested in because they have nothing to do with how a bat works. I'm interested in the interaction between the bat and the ball. So let me factor those out, and using simple kinematics, freshman physics really, one can write a formula like this, expressing the exit speed of the ball as a combination of the ball speed and the bat speed. Very nice. Now let's put in some typical numbers. The numbers are quite interesting. Typical numbers for a typical ball-bat collision near the fat part of the bat, this P is about 0.22. 1 plus P is 1.22. With a 90-mile-per-hour fastball and a 70-mile-per-hour... Oh, I see. Just move over. Okay. Well, I wanted to stand over here so I would be out of people's way, but I can do it here too. I'm running into the left wall, it looks like. The important issue is that this number is a lot bigger than this number, meaning that bat speed is much more important than ball speed. Now, that's certainly no surprise to anybody, I think. What might be surprising, and it certainly was surprising to me before I first put in the numbers, was how much more important it actually is. The second thing that you might find interesting with this is how small this number is. If you took a super ball, a highly elastic ball, and collided it with a brick wall, completely massive, rigid wall, it would bounce back with essentially its initial speed. P would be about 1. For the ball-bat collision, P is considerably smaller. So now we're really focusing in on what's important. We want to ask, why is this so small? In fact, the way I want to phrase the question is, where does the energy go? And there are three different sources of energy loss that I want to talk about. Okay, the first is rather simple, and I'll use the transparency rather than the bat itself. The first is rather straightforward. When the ball, imagine the bat being initially at rest, when the ball hits the bat tends to recoil. Okay? So it's not like hitting a brick wall. The brick wall is infinitely massive. The bat recoils, and the amount by which it recoils depends on the mass of the bat. The heavier the bat, the less recoil, and energy that goes into the bat's recoil is energy that did not go into the ball. So this is a source of energy loss as far as the ball is concerned. Now, all other things being equal, one desires the bat mass to be as high as possible to reduce the amount of energy lost to the ball. Of course, all things are not equal, and it's not as easy to swing. You can't get as high a bat speed with a heavy bat as you can with a light bat. That's the subject of Terry Bahel's talk. I won't get into that any further. Suffice it to say that this is simply a source of energy loss. Now, the bat is an extended object. When the ball hits the bat at the center of mass, it can just recoil. But if it's off the center of mass, it can also rotate. Okay? And the amount by which it rotates, this process here is essentially momentum conservation, for those of you who like those words, and this is angular momentum conservation. And that depends on how far the impact is away from the center of mass. If it's right on the center of mass, it doesn't rotate. As well as the rotational equivalent of inertia. Okay, I call it the rotational inertia or the moment of inertia. The larger the moment of inertia is, the less rotational recoil there is. This is a measure of how much the mass is removed. The distribution of the mass about the center mass. The more extended the object is, the larger the rotational inertia is, and the less energy goes into rotation. One of the things that distinguishes an aluminum bat from a wood bat is that the aluminum bat, the mass distribution is more uniform, it's more extended, and less energy goes into recoil. I will say more about that a little bit later. Okay, what is the second source of energy loss? It's dissipation in the ball. In fact, this is a major, big deal source of energy loss. If you bounce the ball if you just drop a ball onto a hard surface, it doesn't come back to its initial height. It comes back to a lower height. And it's called the coefficient of restitution. It measures sort of the bounciness of the ball. The coefficient of restitution squared is just the ratio of height. So for a baseball, sort of the rules of the baseball of the game tell us that the coefficient of restitution is of order a half. And there is a lot of discussion about whether it's smaller at higher speeds or whether it's different today than it was 30 years ago and things like that. I won't get into that. It's of order a half. A half squared is a quarter, which means the ball only gets back a quarter of the energy that it got stored. Okay, only a quarter of the potential energy gets kicked back into kinetic energy again, or three quarters of the energy is lost. That's a major source of energy loss, and it has a pronounced effect on the flight of the ball. If I change this 0.05 to 0.55, to go up by roughly 10%, it changes the exit speed of the ball by some 7 miles per hour, which could be significant, maybe 35 additional feet perhaps on a fly ball. Now, the important point that I want to get to next is that the bat matters in this business also, and let's see how that comes about. So here is a picture. I couldn't find such a nice picture of a bat, but here's a picture of a tennis ball. I took this from a freshman physics book, actually. A tennis ball colliding with a tennis racket. And you see that both the ball and the racket are compressed. They mutually compress each other. So there is a sharing of energy. Not all the energy is stored in the ball. Some of the energy is stored in the bat. The bat, as it turns out, is rather efficient at returning that energy. The ball, as we have seen, is not very efficient. And so the issue then is, what is the relative amounts of energy stored between the two? For a wood bat, and I take this out of Professor Adair's book, because I haven't done any measurements myself, he estimates that roughly 2% of the energy, of the potential energy, is actually stored in the bat, in a wooden bat, rather than a ball. So it almost doesn't make any difference how efficient the bat is. It's only storing 2% of the energy, so it doesn't have much to offer either way. And so the effective coefficient of restitution for a collision of a ball with a wooden bat is still around 0.5. But now the aluminum bat, that's different. The aluminum bat is a very thin shell. Okay, and bat manufacturers try to make it as thin as possible without having the ball dent the bat. It's compressible. It's maybe 5 maybe 10 times more compressible than a wooden bat. As maybe as much as 10% of the energy is stored in the aluminum bat, compared with only 2% in the wooden bat, and it's very effectively restored. Okay, and as a result, the coefficient of restitution for a ball hitting an aluminum bat, the effective coefficient of restitution, is larger, maybe 10% larger. The bat manufacturers even tell you that it could be 20% larger. Okay. Who knows whether they're right or not, but it's certainly, there's no question that it's larger. This is what ball players call, or recreational softball players, that call the trampoline effect. Okay, so that's the second source of energy, and I've already pointed out, by the way, a couple of places where the aluminum bat is better than the wood bat. I'll tell you another one in a second. Now I really do want to use the bat. Where is the third source of energy loss? It's vibrations in the bat. And I want to try, and this is the, everything I've said so far could be understood with freshman physics. This is the one case where you have to go beyond freshman physics to understand. We all know that the bat can vibrate. You mishit the ball, it hits in the wrong part of the bat, it hurts, you hear a thud, it isn't, you don't hear that nice crack. Sometimes the bat breaks. You have excited vibrations. You feel the sting of those vibrations in your hand. And energy that goes into vibrations is, again, energy that didn't go into the ball. So this is destructive energy, okay? It's energy that you don't want to excite. Now, you can see this picture that I found. Look, this is absolutely amazing when I look at this thing. The ball has just left the bat. It looks like it hit right at the very end, and this thing is bending. Look how much this thing is bending, okay? It looks sort of like this, okay? You can think of this. You can think of this as like a guitar string, if you like. This is the lowest mode of vibration of the bat. You can, these nodes here, these are very important. These are fixed points, and you can think of these two fixed points, and the bat is just sort of bending around those two fixed points. Okay, the lowest frequency is about 170 hertz. There are higher overtones. Each additional overtone has an additional node and a correspondingly higher frequency. It's harder to bend. The bat is stiffer the more you try to bend it, and so the frequency comes out to be higher. The shape of this thing is such that you see in the thin, flexible handle, the amplitude of this vibration is bigger than it is in the fat part of the bat. This is exactly what you'd expect. Now, here's what you can do, by the way, if you don't believe me. You can hear these vibrations. If I hold this thing right and tap it, you can hear the vibrations. And now you hear the vibration has gone away. And now you hear it back again. This is the node right here. And I could turn the bat around and I could find another node in the handle. That's the node of the lowest vibration. Now, there is some important physics here. First of all, the ability to excite a particular mode of vibration is considerably reduced if the collision occurs right at a node. You saw, when the ball hit the bat at the node, there was no vibration, no energy going into that vibration, at least for the fundamental. So where the nodes are important. And because it's an interesting, I haven't really completely tried to understand why it is the way it is yet, but the lowest few modes of the bat all have nodes stacked up right in the fat part of the bat near the barrel. So it looks like that's the best place to hit the ball. Well, of course, that's no surprise, right? But that seems to be the best place because of all those nodes stacking up there. Now, the other thing which is, that is actually a rather deep fundamental principle of physics is that What really matters here is not so much how much of a force I exert on this bat. I could exert a bigger force as I want, but I'm not going to excite a vibration unless I impulse the thing. You have to impulse it to excite the vibration. What matters is the time of the collision in addition to the amount of force. Okay? And generally speaking, only those vibrations are excited for which the frequency of the vibration is less than or about equal to 1 over the collision time. So for the collision of a ball with a bat, the collision time is, let's say it's of order 1 millisecond, roughly speaking. That means only vibrational modes up to about a kilohertz, 1,000 cycles per second, are going to be excited. Maybe 1,500 is more like it, but of that order. So that means only the lowest few modes, lowest four typically, are important. That means you can really do a very serious calculation of these things because you don't have to know a lot about the bat. All you have to do is know what's going on at about below about 2 kilohertz, and that's all. Okay, so I did that. How much time do I have? About 5 minutes. Okay, I can't resist showing you this because this a curve with real data on it. You know, look, I'm a physicist, right? I'm an experimental physicist. I like to take data and compare with theory. Okay, so here is a particular bat. It's this particular Louisville Slugger bat. Calculations and experiments done with a very low impact collision, just a 1 meter per second collision, something you can easily do in the lab. You measure the exit speed of the ball, okay? And this is what you measure, these points here, and this is the curve. This is my calculation. Wow, I mean, when I did this, you know, it was one of the best days of my life. You know, here it is. It goes right through the data. No adjustable parameters or anything, all right? Whereas if you treated the bat as though it were a completely rigid object without everything I told you up to the vibrations but didn't include the vibrations, this is what you would see. Doesn't look anything like the data. I take from this that, first of all, the rigid model of a bat works very poorly. It works reasonably well right here, but beyond that, it doesn't work very well. The exit velocity, notice right at the node of the fundamental here, the exit velocity of the ball is exactly equal to what you would get from a rigid bat, exactly what you'd expect because the vibrations go away there. I take this to the conclusion I draw from this is that the essential physics of a problem is basically understood. Now, I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on this very, very busy transparency. That was a 1 meter per second collision. Now there are no data I can compare with yet, but I'm about to get some. But now let's look at it under more realistic kind of game types of collisions like given here. Once again, here is what you'd expect for a rigid bat. Here is what you'd expect for a flexible bat. Right near around 28 inches or 5 inches or so from the end of the bat, the fat part, you know, the sweet spot of the bat, this is the node of the fundamental. This is the node of the first overtone. Right around the node of the first overtone, around 28 inches, is where these two curves coincide and this thing peaks. But this thing falls off very rapidly as you deviate from that. Red curve, physics 101. Blue curve, you know, graduate physics. Okay, you really have to put in more than just physics 101 to calculate this properly. That's my message there. Second message. I want to talk about sweet spots. Okay, I want to define for you several sweet spots. And these are just words, okay? The physics is contained right here. You could define, if you like, the sweet spot to be where this curve is at a maximum. It's about 28 inches. That's one definition of a sweet spot. You could define it to be at a node of the fundamental. That's at about 27 inches right here. It's not where the curve is a maximum, unlike what a lot of people sometimes say. It's not, okay? Now, before I tell you the next one, I want to call your attention to these curves down here. This is a calculation now. One could as well do the experiment, but this is a calculation. What I'm showing you is the motion of the handle as a function of time. This is in 2 milliseconds, 4 milliseconds, 6 milliseconds, etc., with impacts at three different locations, right around here and then on either side of this. First of all, note that for impact at the node of the fundamental, about 27 inches, the vibrational amplitude that you feel in the hand, that's what this black curve is less. Exactly what you'd expect. You feel less vibration, and there are higher frequency vibrations. The low frequency is not there because you're at a node of the low frequency. If you go on either side of it, you see the low frequency vibrations, and the amplitude is quite large. You would feel a sting of a bat. Okay. The second thing to note is that if you forget about the vibrations, just look at the average. This black curve is oscillating about zero, whereas the other curve is oscillating about some positive number or some negative number. What is that saying? Basically, this 27-inch point is what is known as the center of percussion. It's the place where the recoil at the handle, where the translational recoil, which is in one direction, and the rotational recoil, which is in the other direction, exactly cancel out. So the force that the ball and the bat mutually exert on each other, at that particular point, for a collision at that point, and feeling down in the handle, they exactly cancel out, and you don't feel any reaction forces. This is known as a center of percussion. It's another possible definition of a sweet spot. It also occurs at 27 inches. Notice these three things, all of which involve very different physics issues, all are around the same place. So sometimes the distinction is blurred among them, and as a result, people often confuse them. But these are the physics issues, and which one of these you choose to call a sweet spot, I'll leave it up to you. Okay, I have 2 minutes, and that's just about enough time. Okay, take a look very carefully at this region of the curve here. Notice that the handle, this is down in the handle now. We're looking at the vibrations in the handle. Notice there's a noticeable delay between when the impact first occurs at t equals zero and the first movement of the bat. It's about half or six-tenths of a millisecond. And by that time, the ball and bat have already separated from each other. Okay? This very interesting and very profound result here. The handle barely moves by the time the ball leaves the bat. What does that mean? From a practical point of view, it says that the handle, nothing in the handle, the knob of the bat, or anything near the hand region, can possibly affect the outcome of the collision. The ball doesn't even know that the bat is there. It doesn't know that that part of the bat is even there. It could be almost anything there. That's very, very important and has interesting implications for bat design. Okay, the final thing that I'm going to show you is my wood versus aluminum. I've already told you various reasons why wood is better than aluminum. There's one more that I didn't mention, which is that aluminum is much stiffer than wood, and so the bending vibrations have a higher frequency. They have a higher frequency, they're less likely to get excited during the collision. So that's altogether several reasons why aluminum is better than wood. There's a lot to say, and I'm running out of time, so let me not say it. Let me just call your attention to the dashed curve here, which is my calculation of a wood bat, and I've got a couple of different calculations of aluminum bat. The important point is the following. Right near the peak here, the peaks are slightly shifted because the center of mass is in a different place for the wood and aluminum. They look the same pretty much near the peak, and where the aluminum bat really makes a big difference is on an inside pitch. The inside, this is going towards the handle now. You see the wood bat, the aluminum bat is significantly better. The distribution of this curve is broader for an aluminum bat than for a wood bat. Less, it's more forgiving on inside pitches. In fact, this is a very well-known phenomenon. College players who try to make the transition to the major leagues often have trouble hitting an inside pitch in the major leagues. In college, they're using aluminum bats. They never have to learn as well how to hit an inside pitch because the aluminum bat is so forgiving. Of course, with a wood bat, it's less forgiving, and they have to learn all over again how to do that. Okay, so I've come to the end. Let me put up a final transparency here. I think it's true, and I will have convinced you that the physics of the collision is reasonably well understood. The bat could be quite well characterized. The ball, I should say, is less understood, but it doesn't enter into the problem in such an essential way. There's only gross parameters that you need to know. The essential parameters for a bat design are known, and look, anything that I know or I've learned, I'm sure Hillerich and Bradsby already know it. Thank you. I don't know. I'm not a metallurgist, and I don't know much about properties. I know titanium has been used. Maybe Terry knows about that. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, aluminum is cheap. I think maybe that's one of the reasons why aluminum is used. I'm not sure that's good, and Terry will have some discussion about that, whether it's so good that it's so much lighter. But two different kinds of stiffness, okay? There is the local compression of the bat right at the point of impact. That's the compressibility thing that increases the effective coefficient of restitution. And then there's the ability to bend the bat. And that's a more global phenomenon, not a local phenomenon. So they're two different things. Yeah.